So we're now going to switch gears from looking at the past to looking at ethics. The next speaker is Stephen Carlson. Stephen is the managing partner of Kazowitz, Benson, Torres, and Friedman Silicon Valley office. He is an IP litigator and focuses on patent and trade secret disputes. Stephen, take it away.
Thank you. Thanks for sticking through the Friday afternoon ethics credit, and I hope that this will be some new news and just some refreshment of the good old principles that we have all been working with. We all do ethics. It's our job. It's our duty to the court. It's our duty to our clients. And so this will teach some new principles that have come up in the last year, as well as some refreshment of the kind of disputes that just keep coming. So the first topic I'd like to talk about is indeed a new privilege that was created in 2016. It's about patent agents. And as we know, there are two classes of practitioners before the patent office. There are patent attorneys who have gone through law school, have a JD, but also patent agents that do not have the JD. And patent agents have had a separate status all to their own. Many of the responsibilities are the same between patent agents and patent attorneys. But then the question is, well, what about privilege? Is there indeed an attorney-client-like privilege that pertains to agents who do not have a JD? And just a little bit of history, some of the case law that has come up in past years. The Supreme Court looked at patent agents in 1963. And the question there was the state of Florida was trying to regulate what a patent agent could and could not say about his services that he was rendering. And the Supreme Court said, no, the state of Florida cannot regulate what this gentleman is doing because his services are uniquely before the United States Patent Office, not in the courts of Florida. But the Supreme Court did recognize that indeed what this gentleman was doing was indeed basically the practice of law. It was equated to the practice of law, even though this person was not himself an attorney. And that was the Sperry versus State of Florida case from 1963. More recently, the Federal Circuit in the Spalding Sports Worldwide case looked at the practice of the drafting the applications, and in particular the submission of invention records, and said that conduct of preparing and submitting the invention records from the inventor to the in-house counsel, and that was an attorney in this case, the in-house legal department, that was a privileged act, even though all the facts that were being channeled to that in-house corporate department would be channeled then to the patent office, and of course the duty of candor, and so all those facts would be going to the patent office, but that was deemed to be a privileged act. Now that was attorneys in that case, not patent agents, but still that's good predicate law. So coming to 2016, we now have a new case in re Queen's University. Queen's University is up in Ontario, and they, like many universities, had a tech incubator that was spun off called Partech. And they were using patent agents for the patent prosecution. And they succeeded in getting patents, and eventually they sued Samsung. And as part of that litigation, Samsung sought communication between the university employees and those non-attorney patent agents. And this apparently was the first time that the patent agent privilege itself, in the context of litigations, has been pushed. And the trial court found that these communications were actually not privileged. They reasoned that the attorney-client privilege is indeed an attorney-client privilege. And this would be a new privilege that was being created, and there's a strong presumption against creating new privileges. And the Federal Circuit granted mandamus when these were ordered produced, and away we went. So the Federal Circuit looked at the different policies on either protecting the communications or having them disclosed. There is a general presumption against the recognition of nude privileges. The basic line that comes out of the case law is that that would be a derogation of search for the truth. It's a lofty principle that the truth should come out, and we should not be getting in the way of the truth coming out, except in very defined, recognized privileges. Federal Circuit looked at some classic service providers that do not get the benefit of the privilege. Accountants, you want your, you know, we as citizens should be fully, full, truthful with our accountants, and we should talk about our privilege fully and openly. However, there is no privilege. So when we, you know, talk about our tax liability, that's all fair game through the accountants. Jailhouse attorneys, these are not actual attorneys, but there's some kind of law clerk responsible for fielding complaints from the inmates, and they are not attorneys often. And when they're not attorneys, there is no privilege, even though they're serving basically as lawyers, helping the inmates with their legal claims. So there's a lot of precedent for not giving out privilege to people that aren't attorneys. You know, obviously, the countervailing principle is that you want to encourage full and frank disclosure with your attorneys so that you can fully vet your legal liability and comply with the letter of justice. And having weighed these different policies, the Federal Circuit came down on the side of the patent agent, saying, yes, there is a patent agent privilege. Recognizing, as we talked about with Sperry, that basically the patent agents are performing legal services, the same duties that a patent attorney would do, well, that's what a patent agent is doing. And there are ethical standards, and we all, you know, they have to take the patent office bar exam in order to qualify. So therefore, given these standards and the same duties as attorneys, they awarded the privilege and protected that. But it's important to realize that it's a very limited scope. It's limited to certain covered tasks, and that's preparing and prosecuting patent applications, consulting with the client to aid in the preparation of the patent application, and the drafting communications to be filed with the PTO or the PTAB for, you know, interferences, reexaminations, and appeals, etc. And the line that the Federal Circuit drew was that it's these communications for those tasks, and also communications reasonably necessary and incident to following those tasks that are privileged even from a patent agent. And that's the basic line. But there's a lot of pitfalls here. And the main lesson is don't be complacent because it is a limited scope. There was a very robust dissent by Judge Reyna at the Federal Circuit that was very long involved dissent, saying, look, truth is a weighty interest, and we want this want the truth to come out. And the fact that patent prosecutors owe a duty to the patent office to disclose what they know, that should cut against shielding the truth that may have been discussed with the patent agent. And the Judge Reyna said, look, there's not a pressing need for this. This is the first time this has come up in many, many years. And the long-running practices have worked. And all these other service providers do not get the privilege. So given the pressing, as Judge Reyna said, the policies against this, we should count on this not expanding. There are limits to this. So patent agents come up in my history in a few situations. One is with bigger law firms. With the prosecution group, we would have some patent agents, and they're working in tandem with patent attorneys. And that's much more likely to be privileged, and those agents are much less likely to do legal-type tasks beyond prosecution. But other companies, particularly startups, smaller companies, when they're weighing their very first legal advisor to hire in an IP context, it might be a patent agent, because they're frankly cheaper. And so as this initial patent agent gets hired on at an early stage in the company, they become the trusted advisor, and the mission may creep. It may become about invalidity opinions or infringement opinions. And then as the company gets involved in more and more fields of law, and I'm seeing this happen right now in a matter personally, that patent agent may get drawn into other disputes. And that privilege is not likely to maintain. Those communications are likely to be fully discoverable. So it's very important to be cautious about whatever acts the patent agents are heading into. And as the legal disputes expand, it's very important to have an outside attorney advisor in the loop. So a question about patent agents? Okay, we'll move on to some disqualification cases. Yes?
Thank you. In my experience, a lot of foreign companies, particularly Asian companies, have legal departments that consist in very large part of non-lawyers, such as patent agents. Do you think any sort of privilege would apply to communications with such clients and to work done by such clients internally?
Yeah, well, this is the situation I'm involved in as well, where it's an Asian client with a local Asian patent agent who, because there's a shared language, that's where a lot of the communication is. And, you know, as the outside lawyer, I'm really trying to rein that in and make sure that the communication flows through, you know, proper legal channels. I think it's absolutely a concern. And it's part of our job is to police that. It's kind of hard to have a blanket rule, but it's likely perilous to not have the communications flow through the outside attorneys. Yeah.
I thought the test was whether that agent had a privilege in its own country. For example, in Canada, it seems like the question would be, does Canada recognize the agent's privilege?
I think that's probably a fair way to look at it. I'm not sure sitting here, but I think that probably is the rule. Yeah, in the back, Karen. Why don't you sing it? Can you sing it?
Not on the spot. I'll compose something later. Patent agents in the process of prosecution have to figure out scope of claims and claim strategy. And if you're looking, unlike Mark suggested earlier, at how do we enforce this patent, you might be looking at infringement issues. You're certainly looking at validity issues. Are those within the scope of the patent agent privilege because it's attached to prosecution?
Yeah, I mean, reasonably incident to prosecution is the standard, and that sounds reasonably incident to me. But, of course, if you've already got the patent, for example, then you're looking at infringement of that patent, well, then probably not. And there's a relationship, and this, you know, people have their established relationships that may have come through an agent, and as that, you know, body of work grows, it may very well extend beyond activities incident to patent prosecution. And then suddenly they're outside and exposed, and a lot of bad things may come out of that if people aren't careful. All right. Well, let's talk about disqualifications. This is a bad case. This is, like, unquestionably a bad case. And, of course, none of us would do this, but the lesson in life is that bad things do happen. And then also then the question is, how far does the taint go when something bad happens? So an attorney named Rutherford worked at a company called Schlumberger doing licensing and litigation, was the director of IP and the deputy GC. This is down in Texas. So many years spent doing litigation and et cetera for Schlumberger. And she investigated a competitor's product called Recon. In a copyright suit, well, that Recon product was protected by a patent called the 319 patent. And I don't know what happened, but Rutherford left Schlumberger. Sounds like probably some bad blood, and promptly joined Acacia, a well-known non-practicing entity company. And very promptly after joining Acacia, she did a few things. She met with the inventors of that patent. She discussed acquiring the patent. She participated in some telecons for selecting outside counsel. She specifically discussed Schlumberger's product as a target of this patent, and then she approved the purchase of this patent and proceeding with a lawsuit. You know, what could possibly go wrong, right? Well, a lot did. Schlumberger immediately raised a DQ issue and separately sued Rutherford in state court for breach of confidence, breach of contract, among other things. And it all went downhill from that. The district court found that her prior work at Schlumberger was substantially related to the work she's doing for Acacia, and found an irrebuttable presumption that she had acquired confidential information from Schlumberger and used that to Schlumberger's detriment. So she was disqualified. But then the district court imputed all that wrongfully acquired knowledge to the entire Acacia legal team. So the district court disqualified all of them. And because all that information had gone from the Acacia legal team to outside counsel, well, that outside counsel got disqualified as well. So it really was a huge crater in the ground, and the district court dismissed the case without prejudice as someone else conceivably could pick up the patent and proceed against Schlumberger. So, you know, some rules, we all know these, but it doesn't hurt to look at them again. A lawyer who has formally represented a client shall not thereafter represent another person in the same or substantially related matter when that person's interests are materially adverse to the former client. And you can't use that information to the disadvantage of the former client. And the Federal Circuit, when this went up to the Federal Circuit, found no problem agreeing with the district court that indeed Rutherford had gained confidential information using the detriment of Schlumberger, and therefore found the disqualification of the attorney appropriate. Furthermore, the Federal Circuit applied Rule 1.1, the ABA model rule, but we've got all jurisdictions have this, to the firm. And the firm in this case was not the law firm only, but also the Acacia legal department, because that was deemed to be a law firm. And as we know from the model rule that we should always remember, when lawyers are associated in a firm, none of them shall knowingly represent a client when any one of them, practicing alone, will be prohibited from the engagement. And then there are, of course, screening rules to and written notice. You know, if you get written notice, written consent, well, that's fine. And that person may need to be screened. None of that happened. No screens were run. No consent was asked. It was just, it happened. And so the Federal Circuit found no problem disqualifying all of Acacia's legal team as well as the outside counsel. Very short concurring opinion at the end from Judge Wallach was basically a call to honor, which is like, this is an aspiration. The Code of Ethics is aspirational, but we need to strive for that. And if we don't strive to reach it, then perhaps we ought to consider that the game's not worth the candle. Don't play games with this, is what he's saying. These are real rules, and everyone gets hurt, especially in this case, the attorney. But the question then comes up, well, what about employee mobility? Clearly, it's a bad case, extreme case. Very hard to justify any of this. But, you know, if you have been in a in-house legal department, what is your freedom to go to, let's say, an NPE, like Intellectual Ventures, for example, or to a plaintiff-type law firm that might go, proceed against your company? Because you're probably not going to get a waiver. And so what is your mobility? And you really need, it's something very hard you need to think about to when you're leaving a company, if you are going to be able to proceed in some fashion on more the plaintiff side of these adverse side of the equation. So let's talk about screens and waivers, because sometimes people think they're doing the right thing and they're not. An attorney at Finnegan represented Audio MPEG in many matters. He's a partner, billed a lot of time, both in PTO actions and in court. Eventually moved to Winston & Strawn. I think the chronology is during this move, that's when Winston & Strawn picked up a case against Audio MPEG. And the attorney that had moved to Winston & Strawn did not work at all on Audio MPEG. And it seems like this probably slipped through the cracks. And Winston & Strawn did not seek a waiver. There was some overlap geographically where the attorney was in the DC office, where certain litigators against Audio MPEG were also working. No evidence that anything was actually disclosed wrongly. But applying the same rules we just talked about, The whole firm was disqualified. The district court weighed the competing policies of allowing employee mobility against the need to avoid an appearance of impropriety. Yes, there was no harm shown, but Winston Strawn could have caught this and could have erected the walls and could have asked for the waivers, and that didn't happen. And the court, you know, noted that the growth of multi-jurisdictional practice by law firms and the mobility of practice attorneys, that creates problems. But we can't just overlook the detriment to appearances of impropriety, and we need to incur the costs and the burden to police this more properly. And so the district court did disqualify Winston Strawn there. Pitches create issues. Case out of Utah this year, an attorney in 2010 pitched a case to assert Ned Mitchell's patent, and some confidence were exchanged. That patent was subsequently acquired kind of through the chain by Applied Asphalt, who then sued another company, the Sam Corp, and that Sam Corp engaged that original attorney who had previously pitched 5 years before that patent work. And the plaintiff then, the now patent holder, sued to disqualify the defense counsel. And, you know, we all do pitches, and it's perilous because you are creating an attorney-client relationship through this pitch. And Utah has enacted Rule 1.18. Now, we don't have that exactly in California, but we do have evidence rules in California that basically trigger this, and the model rules may apply, and the it's being promulgated currently, but this is enforced now in Utah. So a person who consults with a lawyer about the possibility of forming a client lawyer relationship is entitled to these privileges, and the lawyer, even if they don't proceed with engagement, shall not use that information. And then the test is, down the stream, is would what was used, would that be significantly harmful? And if so, no lawyer in that firm can use that information and would be then barred. So, and we've got in California a similar rule through the evidence code. And in this case, the court came down and said, well, the knowledge that the attorney learned, well, that was probably not significantly harmful to the patent plaintiff. 5 years had elapsed, memories had faded, no one could find the documents that were turned over, and it's ultimately the plaintiff's burden to carry the burden of the disqualification, and really the evidence wasn't there. Now, the court did say that the lawyer, if he found any notes, would have to turn those over to the court, and that threat of disqualification continued to hang over the lawyer, but given the record, the court could not find the reason to disqualify. But it is, for all of us who pitch, it's a cautionary tale that we should be very careful accepting confidential information from the prospective client. I think it's fair to say if you do receive confidential information and you don't get the case, you should dispose of that information. It's our job, and we need to do that because you could get caught in a bad situation with this confidential information. So just a way to we need to police our practices to make sure we don't get caught in this situation. I got a chuckle out of this one, and it was all fine. I did work at Fish and Richardson, and I know the how this can all happen. Prior case, Fish represented 39 defendants in one of these massive multi-defendant cases, the Geotank case, and they did get an advance waiver. I hated sending those out. Hated asking clients to sign this advance waiver, saying, you know, we are free to sue you. It never felt right, and you know, but it was something that we were, you know, it's part of the practice, I guess. And that case wrapped up pretty quickly, no discovery, kind of in, kind of out, never got hot, and they were one of 39 defendants. And that ended in 2013, basically, a little bit of work, like an hour in 2014. Meanwhile, another phone rang, took the case, and by March by early 2015, realized that the same client was now going to be a target in the new case. And fish. Meanwhile, I thought it was funny. Kept sending out the webinar alerts, you know, client alerts, and come to their CLEs. And the client very much thought that Fish was their lawyer, and was very surprised to find that, in fact, Fish was then on the other side. The engagement letter, very properly done, very narrow, narrowly tailored to just this one above-caption case with Geotag. The cases were not related, really. With Geotag involved store locators and geopositioning, where the new case was about pharmacy dispensing of the Cialis drug. And very little had been learned by Fish during that initial case. And the court found that the cases were not substantially related, and so on that basis, found no need to disqualify. Interestingly, the court did not reach the issue of the advance waiver. And this is something that all law firms are keeping an eye on, is are those enforceable? And the court, the language in the case law is that those advance waivers have dubious validity unless the potential conflict is spelled out with scrupulous care. So a general blanket advance waiver that would make the attorney client, the law firm says that they're free to sue and act adversely to the plaintiff, to the client in the future, those may not be enforceable. And this is a big question on if you can enforce those. But the court ultimately did not reach that question. But just some basic practice pointers on this. When you do your engagement letters, you want very strict limits on what this engagement's for. In that case, it was just for the above captioned Geotag case, nothing else. They did have the advance waiver, but honestly, given this case, asking for those, I remember, always harms, I think, the attorney-client relationship. It's awkward asking your client to sign that, and I think you can really take some harm for asking for those. And whether or not they're enforceable anyways is very much up in the air. Another good practice pointer is very prompt issuance of the termination letter once the matter's concluded. Here, the termination letter came the same month that the new adverse case was going to proceed. So the timing was very suspect, and the court mentioned that. So, you know, much better to get those out quickly. And then you want to rethink, you know, is it really worth taking on these small engagements when these much bigger conflicts can arise? So I think my time is up. So any questions? All right. Oh, there's a question in the back. David.
So going back to the example of the Acacia case, where in that case the attorney was continuing to at least ostensibly practice law, but it's fairly common in the patent business for attorneys to kind of, you know, go to quote-unquote the business side of that, and
right.
How do you think the case turns, assuming the attorney had stopped practicing law at that point and was ostensibly the business person at Acacia as opposed to the in-house counsel at Acacia?
You know, it's all about the confidences, or the confidence is being disclosed to the detriment of the former client. And that, it sounds like in that hypothetical, well, the business side of Acacia is the lawsuits. And the confidences, they found an irrebuttable presumption that confidence were disclosed. I would think that's probably not going to come out well for the person that moved. It's not so much the fact of practicing law, it's the fact of the likely disclosure of the confidences. And that duty, of course, is still owed to the prior client. Anything else? All right. Thank you all.